Today on Rocking the Suburbs, we begin our journey into Metallica Week.
There's only one thing to do then.
What's that, Mike?
Hit the lights!
Okay, well, welcome to Rocking the Suburbs. I'm not Jim Linehan. I'm Stephen Routledge, and with me is not Patrick Foster, but the one and only...
Mike Coley.
Right, Mike, how you doing, mate?
What's going on?
We, a few months back, we did Iron Maiden Week, and that didn't scare off, didn't scare the horses enough that they've let us back in for Metallica Week, so...
We're back.
We're going louder, we're going faster, we're going heavier. We're here to do a whole week of shows about Metallica for you. So
strap in.
Let's just strap in and let's dive in ourselves, Mike, shall we? So before we get into a little bit of history of the band, and sort of start working through their career, what was your introduction to Metallica, Mike?
My intro, I've been trying to piece it together, so it's kind of a little bit of hazy, but there used to be a radio show here back in the 80s called Metal Shop, hosted by Charlie Kendall. It was a syndicated radio show that aired on Friday nights. And one of our local stations used to carry that. And one night, I used to listen to it with my little radio with a tape in it every week to record songs off of it. And I remember the week they played, they featured Ride the Lightning. And they played Ride the Lightning, and they played For Whom the Bell Tolls on the show. And I recorded those on a cassette. I had heard about Metallica, but I don't think I'd heard anything by them at that point up until this show that I was listening to. And so the next morning, my buddies and I would play basketball down at the park at the end of the street where I live. And we'd all walk around with our Walkmans on and our jean jackets with our patches on the back and all that stuff. And we'd play basketball in Timberland boots down at the park. And I walked down to the park. And my buddies were already down there, and I said, you guys got to hear this. And they didn't like it at first. It was too heavy for them, I guess. They were big into Motley Crue at the time.
Right.
I was kind of into Motley Crue at the time, but I really fell off of their wagon quickly, especially after hearing Metallica.
Well, as we'll no doubt get into, Metallica very much an antithesis of Motley Crue, yeah. That was kind of, they most definitely didn't want to be Motley Crue, did they?
So. No, not at all.
So, oh well, good stuff, yeah. No, for me, because I was a little bit late getting into music as a teenager, I was aware of Metallica before I actually ever heard anything by them. There was a guy in my chemistry class, he was a big metalhead, and I remember seeing him with the Metal Up Your Ass t-shirt that you had, the one with the toilet seat on it, which obviously was quite eye-catching,
Yeah, I couldn't get away with that at my house.
No. Because I wasn't really into music then, I was just aware that it was a band, My first musical awareness is when One came out as a single. I think it went sort of straight into the top 10 in the UK. I was listening to Top of the Pops, and it was like, oh, new entry this week, Metallica with One. And I was like, well, this is a little bit different.
Just slightly.
So it's kind of from that point on, I was aware of Metallica. And as we'll no doubt discuss later in the week, I bought the Black Album, and that really kind of then got me, I sort of worked backwards from there, But okay, well, we've left enough breadcrumbs of things we're going to get to later in the week. But let's just rewind and start back in 1981, Mike, which is when Metallica was formed. And for a band that's known from being from the San Francisco area, some may be surprised to know that they didn't form in San Francisco, but actually in Los Angeles. Lars Ulrich and James Hetfield were both living in the LA area from vastly different backgrounds. And Lars placed an advert for musicians into new wave of British heavy metal, which was a thing that was taken off at that time and that he was heavily into. And that's how initially Lars and James Hetfield, the drummer and guitarist and vocalist of Metallica, came together. Yeah, they started from small beginnings there. And one thing that I'm sure you'll agree, Mike, has outlined their career throughout and was there right at the very beginning is that I put down in my notes the chutzpah of Lars Ulrich.
Yes. He's definitely one that he's got a go-getter attitude, I guess you could say.
Yes. So for those not aware, Lars is the son of a tennis professional. So he had quite a bohemian lifestyle moving around on the tennis tour around. And he initially, you know, I think he probably had the talent to make it as a pro, but he was more into metal than tennis, wasn't he? So,
yeah.
He was more into posing with a tennis racket than using it as a sports implement. he actually performed with Metallica. Get the timeline right. It was kind of after Metallica had just kind of started, but then he decamped off to the UK, didn't he, for a month or two.
And, yeah, I think that's the timeline there.
Yeah, so I think him and Hetfield had met up and they started sort of rehearsing some stuff. And then Lars went over to the UK for about a month or two and basically followed Diamond Head, who are a band who are hugely, hugely influential on Metallica and their sound, and basically followed them on tour around the UK to the point where he was just hanging out at, in their houses and stuff like that. And at no point whatsoever mentioned that he was in a band and was interested in forming a band. And came back sort of super inspired by that and keen to get Metallica really going, which he did with a chap called Brian Slagle of Metal Blade Records, who some may be familiar with.
Pioneer. He's a pioneer in metal for sure.
Yeah. So,
Brian Slagle.
Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit on what happened there, Mike, with Slagle and the tape kind of scene that was springing up around then?
Yeah. So Lars was, as you mentioned, big time into Diamond Head and the new wave of British heavy metal bands like Saxon and Tigers of Pantang and Angel Witch. A lot of bands that we mentioned during Iron Maiden week, actually, because Iron Maiden came up in that same scene. Iron Maiden was also influential to them, but Lars had these albums, and he would trade those tapes to get people to listen to this stuff that he was completely into that was difficult to find in the U.S. And he introduced Slagle to that.
Yeah, and when it was still just him and James, he said to Slagle, "Can my band get on your tape?" I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, again, goes back to the sheer front of the guy.
And he didn't even have a band.
No, he just had him and James. And so they recruited a friend of, I believe it was James, called Ron McGovney, who was the initial bass player. And that original demo that they put together featured James's guitar teacher on playing lead guitar on the initial demo that went on to the Metal Massacre compilation, which was the first appearance of Metallica.
Yeah, Lloyd Grant was credited with the guitar solo on the first song.
Yeah. Now, they quickly got another lead guitarist and someone that will be familiar to many listening here, a guy called Dave Mustaine, who will feature in this story a little bit more at various points. But Dave Mustaine, who, as we will cover later, went on to form Megadeth, was a virtuoso guitar player, and much like Lars Ulrich, a man with quite a lot of self-confidence and self-belief.
To say the least.
Yeah, unlike, to be fair, James Hetfield at this time, he was very kind of reticent to be the frontman. I think there was always talk of him actually just playing guitar rather than being the front man. But anyway, so the initial version of Metallica was Lars, James, Dave Mustaine and Ron McGovney on bass. So they started playing a few shows in the California area, including, I think, their second ever show was opening for Saxon at the Whiskey A Go-Go, I believe, Mike. which again, so sometimes you feel it's just fated that you're going to succeed, don't you?
Exactly.
bands I've played in didn't get their second shows opening for major bands in major venues. But anyway,
but that was Lars actually putting that together too, I believe.
Yeah, he just again just yeah just no fear, just supreme self confidence, and but soon they were playing up in the San Francisco area, and they saw a band called Trauma, and Trauma had a guy playing on bass, who basically blew them away, didn't he, Mike?
Oh yeah, absolutely. He would blow anybody away.
Yeah, so we're talking about Cliff Burton here, and basically, he was. How many times have you seen a band, Mike, and you thought the bass player is so impressive, I'm going to move to the city where he lives to get him to join my own band?
Yeah, and we talk about Lars's overconfidence, and he couldn't even win Cliff over to move to LA. Cliff was like, "No, I'm staying here."
Yeah, he was very much a homebody, wasn't he? Yeah.
If you want me, you got to move up here, and the whole band just picked up and moved to San Fran.
That was basically So the reason that Metallica is seen as a Bay Area thrash is such a thing is basically because Cliff Burton was like, "No, I'm happy living here. Thanks. You're gonna have to come to me if you want me." And it says everything about the musicianship of Cliff Burton, which we will touch on an awful lot. Certainly talking about these first three albums, that the band was like, "Yeah, we'll move to the other end of the state because you're so good that we need you in our band." And so they upsticks to San Francisco, and basically get to a point where a couple of very influential people in the history of certainly thrash metal and metal generally, Marcia and Johnny Zazula, who are based in New York, get them signed to their fledgling little label called Megaforce, through hook and by crook, and basically them remortgaging their house and all these sorts of various scams, get enough money together to get Metallica to record their debut album. But it's not without a little bit of upheaval and personality clashes and things that, again, will recur. But just before they go in to record what will become their debut album, Dave Mustaine is fired from Metallica. a somewhat fractious relationship, shall we say.
Yeah, a little contentious. That's when they recruited Kirk Hammett.
That's correct, yeah. So Kirk Hammett, who was, again, in the San Francisco area in a band called Exodus, who, again, many of you may have heard of, he'd been lined up to, Lars and James had already decided that basically Mustaine was out of control. I mean, he was a raging alcoholic and using lots of other substances, starting fights, causing grief. And also, he's a man, of not an insignificant ego. And so it was just too much, basically, for them to all get along. So they put him on a Greyhound bus back to California. Kirk Hammett flies in, having learned sort of from the demos Mustaine's parts, and they go into the studio and record what will become Kill 'Em All.
Recorded in Rochester, New York.
Yeah, not far from you, Mike, eh?
Yeah, a couple hours away.
Yeah, it's let's take a little listen to something from Kill 'Em All. We'll fire in as with the opening track, perhaps, which is called Hit the Lights. So let's take a quick listen to this, and then we'll continue talking about Metallica.
We'll be right back.
There we go, Mike. What's your,
that's what kicked what's everything
your
up.
When hit the lights?
Oh, how can you not rage to that one? That's the one that started it all. It started a movement, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way it builds up the intro, we're kind of like, it's teasing you. They're kind of like, it's building. And then suddenly that riff kicks in and it's like Greased Lightning. It's like, okay, this is not Black Sabbath. I mean, they've clearly listened to Black Sabbath, but this is not Black Sabbath.
Yeah, and you could pick up on that. If you've listened to any Diamond Head at all, you can definitely pick up the Diamond Head influences in that.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. I mean, there's not anything that the guys in the band would deny. I mean, they openly, you know, multiple times have paid tribute to the influence Diamond Head had on them. And I know when they were first starting out and playing gigs, because they were into these obscure sort of new wave of British heavy metal bands that no one else in America had heard of, they would play covers of these Diamond Head songs, and people would think they were Metallica originals. Yeah,
yeah, why not?
Yeah. So,
I got to say though, I mean, back when I was first getting into this kind of stuff, you know, before the internet, you had fanzines or magazines, and the liner notes in records is where I found so much music to listen to from these bands, especially Metallica. I never would have heard of Diamond Head or any of the new wave, really, except for maybe Iron Maiden, if it weren't for their unabashed support and liking of these British bands that nobody in the U.S. was really hearing. So I sought out Diamond Head. I sought out Blitzkrieg. Tigers of Pantang, stuff like that, just based on reading the liner notes in the albums of Metallica's albums.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing, and what strikes you, isn't it, Mike, is, I mean, even going back and listening to it fresh, there's a number of things that strike you, but yeah, but it was definitely a case of they took those influences, but they just went faster and louder and heavier. Yeah, it was definitely its own thing. It was, which basically is what became thrash metal. You know, it was just taking all those things that their influences and just putting their even more intense spin on it.
Yeah, I mean, there were other bands doing similar type stuff in the Bay Area at that time, you know, namely Exodus being one of them. But they just took it to that next level, and
yes,
they just hit the gas pedal and didn't let up.
Yeah,
and then people jumped in the back of the car with them and followed them along.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, for all the reports of those early live shows, they were fairly incendiary, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, the thing that also strikes me as well is it's just, apart from the fact that yes, that is actually James Hetfield singing, ladies and gentlemen, that is, despite what you might imagine he sounds like if you come to him later at Metallica later in their career, yeah, he hadn't quite found his voice at this stage. But also just the musicianship of both of Cliff and Kirk. You know, although Kirk was pretty much just playing Mustaine's parts at this stage, you know, that's some seriously good guitar playing on there.
There it is.
And talking of Cliff Burton, let's take a listen to his showcase track from that first album, Kill 'Em All, which, as we see, I referenced the T-shirt with the Metal Up Your Ass slogan, which was actually the title that they wanted to call their debut album. And
the record label said, no.
More sensible heads prevailed. The fact that no shop would probably, you know, certainly at that time in the early 1980s in America was going to stock an album called Metal Up Your Ass. So it became the slightly less controversial Kill 'Em All. But let's take a listen to Anesthesia Pulling Teeth, which is a real showcase for basically why the guys wanted Cliff Burton in their band. We'll be right back. okay, Mike, I just want to let it get to where the band starts coming in and, like, I mean...
Just turns into a little jam session behind him.
It's amazing because it's so different to everything else that's on the album, isn't it?
I remember first hearing that, and I was amazed that it was a guy playing the bass with all the effects, you know, the wah pedals and just the way he was playing. And he's, you know, he mixed in some of that classical influence that he was trained in.
Yep.
And it wasn't thrashy by any stretch, but it fit. You know, it was completely different, but it still fit within the context of that album.
Yes, and I think it also sort of points out just what an individual Cliff Burton was, because yeah, the rest of the guys, they look like guys in metal bands. Cliff Burton looked like a guy who just wandered off the stage at Woodstock.
Yeah, bell bottoms. You know,
he's got his wispy little tash, his long hair, and his belt. Let's say the bell bottom trousers. He's completely just like he knew his own mind. He knew his own music, and I think the classical influence which he picked up on there. I mean, I think Bach was his like number one musical hero, which is not normally the case for most bass players in a metal band.
Right. I mean, you have to go to like Yngwie Malmsteen to get any kind of classical in the metal world.
Yes, but certainly not at this time. Yeah. It shows just what a different element that he brought to their music, and I think it's hard to underestimate the influence that has, and that will become more prominent, particularly as we get into the next two albums. But anything else you wanted to mention about Kill 'Em All before we head on, Mike?
No, I just, you know, I remember a friend of mine had these magazines in the U.S. at the time. Megaforce Records would put out full-page ads with all the different bands that they had on their label. And I remember distinctly seeing the Kill 'Em All cover in that advertisement. And a buddy of mine actually had the record and let me borrow it, so I recorded that onto a tape. Along with Anthrax's first album, and that tape got listened to so much. Oh my goodness, it was. Yeah, I listened to that incessantly, but it was based on, you know, that show, that Metal Shop show that I used to listen to, and these magazine ads. Otherwise, I don't know how I would have heard of them. But people, you know, I'd put all their logos on my notebooks in school. And. And these guys that I would hang out with, they're like, these aren't even real bands. What are you doing? What are you just making these things up?
I mean, they're off to a flying start, Mike, weren't they? They're off to a flying start. And, so they hit the road, lots of touring. And in 1984, along came their second album, Ride the Lightning, which... was a big step up, I would say, in terms of as an album overall. And there's still a couple of tracks that use some bits that they'd written with Dave Mustaine. So he's credited on a couple of the tracks, the title track and Call of Cthulhu, as a co-writer on those. But they're sort of... It's a much more confident-sounding album, isn't it, Mike?
Definitely. They spread out big time with their sound, and you know the songs got longer, a little bit more progressive sounding. They cut back a little bit on the thrashiness. They even had an acoustic ballad type song on this album.
They're already starting to broaden their wings which is no doubt, as we'll get to, is part of the reason why they've sort of eventually outgrew their own scene, you know. the beginnings of them moving away from thrash are already there on this album, which contains a number of absolute classics, which feature heavily in their set lists to this day, as do plenty from Kill 'Em All as well. For me, there's three kind of real standout tracks on the album, though, Mike. For Whom the Bell Tolls. Fade to Black, the inverted commas ballad that you mentioned there, although it's not really
a ballad, like, but ballad-ish.
This is not Yeah, this is not, we say, Motley Crue, so it's not. Yeah, and also Creeping Death, which again is a real sort of a thrash metal classic there. So, right, well, let's take a listen to For Whom the Bell Tolls, and we'll dive a bit more into Ride the Lightning. To turn it off, Mike, isn't it really? It's
yeah, well, since we started talking about doing these shows, I've been listening to Metallica nonstop, and I always go back to this album.
Yeah, it's I mean again, Cliff's bass is all over, particularly that intro with the wild bass again at the intro there, and then you get through enough riffs before the lyrics come in that you could build like two or three songs around, and they just throw in all these great riffs and lines into just like the intro For Whom the Bell Tolls. The what I thought, it just suddenly struck me just listening to it again there. You know how Sean Connery got the part of James Bond? It was that after he left the audition, they looked out the window, Cubby Broccoli, and so they saw him walking across the street, and they said the way he walked, he looked like a panther. The way he loped across the street, and that kind of that bass line and the riff there is kind of like that. It's like it's almost like a boxer swaggering up to the ring, isn't it? You know, there's a real
I could see that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's got that real kind of like don't mess with me intent. But even again, much slower than something like Hit the Lights or Whiplash or Seek and Destroy from the first album. You know, the bell that you hear at the beginning of the track name, Mike, you know, that's not actually a bell.
Yeah, it's Lars banging on an anvil, right?
That's correct, yes. It was they recorded this in Denmark, Copenhagen, back in Lars's homeland, the producer on this album and indeed the next two albums, a guy called Fleming Ramerson. And, I don't think the budget stretched to hiring out a church and setting up the mics and recording the church bell. So, they just hit a anvil with a hammer at the top of the stairs at the back of the studio, and that's what you hear.
He had me fooled. Until recently, I thought it was a bell all along.
Yeah, an absolute stone cold classic track, regardless of genre. You know, never mind. Yeah, and a song that features actually we'll talk about it again later in the week as well. But an absolute classic. But the whole album is exceedingly strong, isn't it, Mike? There's not really any kind of weakness there.
Yeah, there's no skipping tracks on this one.
No.
Escape, maybe.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of the one song that kind of doesn't really fit the feel of the album, but it's still Metallica.
Yes, absolutely, and they've definitely got their own sound now as well, haven't they?
Yeah, they've definitely developed that sound.
James's vocals are getting much more, he's finding his own voice. He's still not fully there to what he'd become, but he's getting there. So, should we take a listen to someone else then, Mike? Well, maybe hit Creeping Death. Does that sound good?
A stone cold classic.
So we'll keep them coming then. That's it.
Thank you.
Egyptian history for you. Compliments of James Hetfield.
Indeed, and whilst his voice hasn't fully developed into the sort of the real growl and his that we get later on, it's leaps and bounds ahead of what it is on Kill 'Em All. When it's all, it's more sounding like those LA bands they were getting away from, it's much more getting his own voice coming in there,
Yeah, little slightly more harmony in his voice instead of just screaming into the microphone.
Yes, yeah, and he's getting more of that baritone kind of thing going on, but. So again, they were touring relentlessly and certainly getting a reputation for being a fantastic live band, which was building up their following because they weren't getting any radio play anywhere at this point in their, or not very much radio play at all in the mainstream or media attention. They're very much still an underground band.
And this one was recorded for Megaforce Records originally, and Music for Nations, I believe. Was the UK label?
The way they changed labels, was slightly the timing was slightly differently because they had a different deal in the UK and Europe as they did to United States. So, I think at this point we should mention a company called Q Prime, which is two guys called Cliff Bernstein and Peter Mensch, who, at the time were managers of Def Leppard, another new wave of British heavy metal band who had gone on to somewhat greater success by this stage, in America. Certainly they were far bigger in America this time than they were in the UK. But Q Prime managed Def Leppard and they wanted to manage Metallica and they basically ended up Metallica ended up leaving the Zulus and going with Q Prime, who then immediately started to try to get them onto a major label and push them on to the next level, and which ultimately ended up being on Elektra in the US and Phonogram in the UK. And so I think that's probably a good place for us to leave day one, Mike. Just sign with their new management company, off to heading towards, but not quite yet on major labels, and greater things await.
Much greater things with the next album for sure.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, we will save that for tomorrow. I'll play out with a little bit of Fade to Black. That seems appropriate to finish our first day. And I'll talk to you again tomorrow, Mike, and we'll continue Metallica Week.
Cheers.
And I should just add that if you have any thoughts on our what we've talked about today, you can contact the show. It's at Suburbs Pod on all the socials, or you can call the Suburban Party Line, which is 612-440-1984. And if you want to get hold of me, I'm at Powderfinger71 on the Twitter, and just Stephen Routledge on the Facebook. And Mike,
I am at Mike Coley on Twitter and Mike Coley on Facebook. Coley with a K. Figured out from there.
Okay. That's it. Yeah. You can find us. We're out there. Right. Speak to you tomorrow, Mike.
Cheers. Yeah, what is the number? That's all I know is 1984.